Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, this is Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, there is a book I read a little while back, and it's referenced in the title of this podcast, The Werewolf Principle by Clifford D. Simic. And I found it really interesting. It's not perhaps not Simic's best work. He's probably best known for a book called City, which won a Hugo Award.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like they came up to Clifford, you know, a really established sci-fi dude, and they said, "Hey, we want you to write a novel about werewolves from space." And then he set out and like wrote the most intelligent, interesting take on that concept possible.
Of course.
Instead of it just being werewolves landing and running around howling at things, it involved a guy
howling at the moons.
Yeah. Yeah, which gets into the interesting argument that I've always wondered. It's like, what would happen if a werewolf landed on the moon? Would they be a wolf all the time? Would they be affected by what the Earth was doing?
Would they be howling all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. But Clifford Simic's whole take was that he decided to make this a person who had been engineered to adapt to different environments and sent off into space. So he goes to, if he were to land on Mars, his body would rapidly change so that he could, you know, live on Mars,
right?
Et cetera. And anyway, he's returned to Earth and he keeps changing into these previous forms. And that's the base. There's also something really like humans live in houses that can fly around, and they're,
sweet.
And they're brownies, like little, creatures that live in the woods.
So isn't he like 200 years old or something by the time he returns?
Yeah, yeah,
I believe
so.
About this way?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's got a lot of living.
Yeah. But it's such
he's a conforming.
But at heart, it's such a fascinating concept because,
yeah.
we still talk about terraforming a lot. We talk about, I mean, one of the basic models of spaceflight is let's take a little bubble of our environment and let's, blast it up into orbit. Because we are ultimately, we're creatures that have evolved to live, only in a very, small region of our own atmosphere.
Right.
Just a small portion of the Earth's crust, because the crust also, in some definitions includes the atmosphere. So we're only, really supposed to live in this one little section, but we keep pushing the boundaries. You know, we want to climb Mount Everest. We want to live in space. And then we want to, have our little environment when we're in orbit. We want to turn, Mars into Arizona, you know,
right.
And you see these fantastic science fiction visions, where we've gone out and done that to all these different worlds, where we just find, you know, exoplanet after exoplanet, change it into Florida, change it into, you know, Vacationville.
Right, right. We're looking at you, Richard Branson.
Yeah.
But, and then you think, okay, well, I mean, fish, they're not doing this. They're not saying, wow, I wish I could live on land.
Right.
I didn't have these gills.
Right.
You know, how do I come up with some sort of lung situation here?
Right. They ended up evolving, adapting over time and reaching the point where they, where something could not return to the water.
Right.
And so you run into this interesting argument of what should we be doing to evolve to our setting as opposed to, changing our setting to adhere to our demands.
Right. And of course, an astronaut is like the perfect specimen to look at this whole argument with, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of
because they're not very ideal in terms of trying to actually explore space.
Right. And
nothing against them.
Yeah.
Just our humanness getting in the way.
Well, that's actually a good place to start. Like, what is the ideal astronaut given what we currently know about sending people into orbit?
Yeah.
One of the more interesting things is that you want somebody with ideal methane output.
Of course.
Yeah. And of course, I think we all know what I'm talking about. Farts, of course, in space.
And when you say ideal, I think you mean minimum.
Minimum.
Minimal.
Yeah, because first of all, the methane is, it's flammable. So you have a closed environment. You don't want like a lot of gas going off in there and potentially catching on fire while guys are carrying off, you know, experiments.
Right.
Et cetera.
Plus, it's that whole psychological thing. If you're going to be stuck in a spacecraft for 6 months, you don't necessarily want to be gassing people out, right?
Right, right. There's a guy by the name of Edwin Murphy, and he did some, he conducted some research on this, this is really interesting. There's a whole chapter dealing with this topic in Mary Roach's, latest book, about Mars and the space program. So Murphy used an experimental bean meal, and he fed it to volunteers who had been rigged to a rectal catheter to measure how much gas was going out. And he was interested, in the individual differences, not just the overall volume, but in the percentage of methane,
right,
in the gas in the flatus, I believe is the
flatus,
yes, technical term for it. Because if you're writing a scientific, discussion on something, you don't want to just, keep saying the farts
right.
over and over again.
Fart doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
Insert cheese joke here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what he found was really interesting. He found out that about half the population doesn't produce methane. In their,
I thought that was incredible because it was something about like their bacterial flora.
Yeah, it's important to note that methane itself is like methane doesn't stink, okay?
Right.
There are other things that work in one's digestion besides methane production. So it's not something where these people are not creating, emanating or
expressing
flatus. Though he did, apparently claim that he found one individual who was quote flatus free, which just sounds, I didn't even think that was possible.
I mean, can you imagine? I mean, you could put that on your resume.
Yeah. I mean, people would, or would they hate you? I don't know. I would feel like if I was in a position to hire somebody and they'd be like, oh, by the way, I'm flatus free. I'd be like, well, I'm not hiring you, jerk. You're going to sit around and just make us look bad.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. We could never blame anything on you.
No. Yeah. I just can't, it would happen. And like the dude would just sit there all smug, like, and just, it would be horrible. Yeah.
But you could always be an astronaut.
Yes, yeah. Being an astronaut would be great,
yeah.
because there wouldn't be any concern with methane at all. So Murphy's whole argument was, hey NASA, you need to focus on getting astronauts who have the proper flatus output for space. You want people that are producing the less hostile flatus,
and only those people.
Right.
Everybody else, you're out of the pool.
Yeah. And then NASA was like, no, we're just going to not serve beans. That's
right.
Going to be our
no cabbage,
answer.
No yeah. broccoli. I think we're going to get go the easier route.
Yeah.
and actually, this guy too. If I understand this correctly from Mary Rich's book, he was like a flatus researcher. Like he was employed as a flatus researcher.
Yes.
Researcher and only a flatus researcher.
This was his life work.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can imagine why he took it so seriously. And didn't he even insert the rectal catheter? Yes, she actually talked about that, the rectal catheter. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's we're laughing, but it's, it's an important area of study if you're talking about sending guys up and gals up into space in this little tiny environment. But it's also like one of the first like real moments, like which way are we going to go? Are we going to change our environment? Or are we going to change us? And this was a chance to not really change us, but to, selectively choose.
Right.
And I mean, granted, there are, minimal, requirements for astronauts and members of any, space program, stuff like, eyesight, blood pressure, height. Obviously they tend to go for people who have at least a bachelor's degree in some sort of science or
right, engineering or math,
et cetera. Yeah. So.
And you have to have kind of a happy-go-lucky disposition.
Right. Yeah. And even like space tourism, most of the models we're looking at, even the ones like, the Branson's whole space tourism deal, as much as they're going to try and cater that to make it available to everybody, certain people are just not going to be eligible to go into space.
Right.
So,
people who have a fear of flying.
Right.
I think are going to be cut off the list.
Yeah. But this
first.
Was a case where NASA could either have said, yes, we're going to go after the people who have minimal flatus, and aren't mm-hmm. methane producers. And they said, no, we're going to change the meal plan.
It's so practical.
So other areas, that Mary Roach brings up, bone mass, of course, is a big deal. You're going to lose bone mass if the more you're in a microgravity environment.
Yeah, and actually, stat that I saw on that was astronauts lose 1-2% of their bone mass for each month they spend in space.
Right.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that black women, for instance, are 7-24% denser in their bones than white or Asian women.
Okay.
And of course, Mary didn't have the data for men, just for the women. And I assume that's tied to osteoporosis research. But conceivably, black men would also have better bone density than white or Asian men.
Right.
So, so it ends up creating an interesting argument there. Should we only be using, minimal flatus, black astronauts?
Why not?
Why not? Yeah. They're going to be more suited for space. And you can take this even one step farther, and that is that maybe they should all be deaf. Because, if anybody's ever had motion sickness, be it on a boat, in the car, et cetera, you get kind of nauseous. Next thing you know, you're throwing up into the floorboard of the vehicle.
Right. And it's an inner ear thing. And
right.
I think
people
used to think it was tied to the stomach, but it's not.
Yeah. It's tied to inner ear. And many people argue that it's kind of a mistake of evolution because vomiting, as much as we may hate it, does serve a number of really key functions. You eat something and it's bad, it's poisonous, you barf it up.
Right.
Start over. And actually animals that don't vomit, that becomes a problem because they eat something they shouldn't eat. I believe horses are like this. They eat something they shouldn't eat, they can't vomit it up. It's more of it becomes a real, problem when it comes to poison control.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of discomfort.
Right, yeah. Cause like with kids, right? If a kid eats something they're not supposed to, a child, not a goat. If a child eats something that he or she is not supposed to, there's the vomiting, right? You can give them Epicac or something, right?
And I'm thinking about this too. Like, this is sort of an accident of nature, right? Because whatever controls our vomiting response is near our inner ear function or something along this. I'm sorry, I don't have the correct terminology, but I sort of scanned that remembering. So that's why we sometimes vomit because we're.
But it serves
sort of
no evolutionary prop. There's no reason for it. It's like, I'm feeling kind of motion sickness, and my body's like, we have to vomit now.
Yeah.
There's
confusion,
no
confusion.
Yeah, it serves no evolutionary advantage.
Yeah.
So the only way to completely get rid of motion sickness is for the human to have a non-functioning inner ear. And so you would conceivably then go for deaf people. So all black deaf astronaut crew with minimal flatus.
All right. It could happen. I guess the problem is that you just keep narrowing the pool to the point where it's probably harder and harder to get astronauts, right?
Unless you create, and this is, I'm throwing this out there as like a future kind of thing, and kind of a potentially scary eugenics kind of thing, but then you create a breeding program, right? Just for astronauts. Just to encourage the traits. We've done it with dogs, and of course that has some horrible effects, in many times, but conceivably, seems to me, you could have a breeding program similar to the, something out of Dune, where you're just breeding for ideal astronauts. And so it's like a genetic, hereditary thing. You create an entire caste or subspecies of astronauts.
I know. And I'm just thinking now of the Island of Misfits and Rudolph Red-Nosed Reindeer and the elf that wanted to be a dentist. Like, there might be that person that's bred to, do this and goes, I don't really want to go to space. But thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you have to sit down with them and be like, but dude, listen, read the words that I'm writing because you're deaf because we bred for that.
Right.
It's like you're deaf. Your bone density is incredible. You have no methane when you break wind. Like, this is for you. But they're like, no, I really, really want to be an artist. So what do you do?
Yeah. Right.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So there's that viewpoint. Like, what if we, step one, we only choose the people that are ideal for space. And then, we could take that a step farther. What if we bred people for space? But then the next step is, what if we engineered people for space? What if we made them made them better. We adapted them for space.
Into the cyborg.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like a simple version of it would be like if you just made people deaf before you send them into space, which is kind of horrifying.
Right.
But
I'm not sure a lot of people would go for that.
Yeah.
They might. I don't know.
But there are a number of interesting changes that could take place that would be less scary, though some of them are pretty scary. So let's look at the cyborg.
Okay.
Now, this is a term that is pretty loaded these days because when I say cyborg, what do you think of?
Well, I think of the Terminator, but I don't think he's technically a cyborg.
Yeah, he was more of a robot covered with
flesh.
With flesh.
Yeah. Darth Vader.
Yeah, I think Darth Vader was pretty cybernetic in his state. RoboCop, perhaps a cyborg.
Okay.
I'm I'm kind of foggy on the explanations in the first two movies. But yeah, you get this idea. It's like a human being that has been augmented terrifically, or terrifyingly with machines.
$6 Million Man.
$6 Million Man is a prime example of a cyborg. Yeah. But again, this is kind of a term that's been taken by science fiction and just sort of they run wild with it. So now you just think of like man with half metal face.
Right.
Kind of thing. The term actually originates, back in, 1960, September of 1960 in, an edition of Astronautics. And this was an article by Manfred E. Kleins and Nathan S. Klein, one with a C, the second with a K, and it was titled Cyborgs in Space. And it's a great read. I'll have to throw up a link to it on the accompanying blog post when this podcast comes out. But they make the huge argument that, like here's just a quote from it that really sums it up. In the past, evolution brought about the altering of bodily functions to suit different environments. Starting as of now, it will be possible to achieve this to some degree without alteration of heredity by suitable biochemical, physiological, and electronic modifications of man's existing, bodies. So.
And so what I thought was kind of cool about this too is that it's not necessarily that they felt like they were changing humans, but that they were improving humans so that they could explore more and they could have more independence to create more and to think more.
Right.
If they weren't burdened by their own physicality.
Right. And plenty of people make the argument that the cyborg has been around for ages.
Right.
Like the second that we skinned an animal and started wearing its fur, cyborg. The second we strapped a wristwatch to our arm, cyborg.
Dentures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are you going to chew? You throw the dentures in, you've augmented the individual with technology to better enable them for their environment.
You've become something more than human.
Right. And certainly we went into a number of these possibilities on the previous, accessorizing podcast about,
right.
Somebody can wear flippers. They're gonna swim faster. We wearable computers, our iPhones. It's like there's so much technology, eyeglasses, contacts, LASIX. These are all examples of something where technology changes the person to better suit them for their environment.
Mm-hmm.
You may think of it as just your everyday life, but your everyday life is here on Earth. But what if the everyday life was in space?
So Kleins and Klein took that, and then they looked at all the problems facing us in trying to exist in space or explore space. And I thought that the solutions they came up with were incredible. I mean, they're really creative, and they're really interesting ways to approach the problem.
Yes.
And I have to tell you though, too, like reading this, I thought, God, this is so crazy. Like this is the Mad Men era. Can you imagine them like sitting in a cocktail party saying, well, I've got an idea about this whole problem of the lungs in space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit, in Mary Roach's book, she talks about like when you would have scientists, the scientist that designed, space travel and the jock astronauts that would do it.
Yeah.
Like sitting in the same room. And the and she pointed out how that the scientists would be like, you know, we could develop a way for them to actually eat parts of the ship on the return trip from Mars, and maybe there's a way we can make it to where they can eat poo or something. You know, it's like they were actually beginning to think along those lines, and the astronauts were like, no, we're not doing that.
That's, right.
Because it's something about like the scientific mindset when you really get into it from a purely logical problem solving frame of mind.
Right.
So there's a hint of that, well, more than a hint of that in this, in their original article, because it's some of the possibilities are a little, they make you shake your head a little, but the logic of it is interesting. And,
right. It's so inventive.
Yeah. For instance, they pointed out that we could have, osmotic pressure pump capsules, and sensing, and controlling mechanisms in our bodies, like
right.
implanted to, give us, medications for blood pressure, to give us basically speed if we need to stay awake, which, you know, they have various medications, on space, on any kind of a space mission, these days, but you generally have to pop the pills yourself.
Right.
But what if it was an automatic thing? And that's one of the huge key, aspects of what was basically Cyborg 1. As outlined in this proposal, and that was that we were taking these different things and turning them over to subconscious functions. So
we're automating these.
Right, yeah. So it wouldn't be like, ooh, I'm getting a little sleepy and I've got a high-pressure job ahead of me. I better, pop some of this this NASA speed. No, it would just kick in.
So all these sensors that are taking the data and recalibrating your body based on that.
Yeah, and other things too in this situation would be like radiation medications, pituitary drugs to help induce hibernation. That was a big key too, because you get into the issue of how are you going to, you know, worry about sending people on long space voyages where, you know, they're going to be sitting around doing nothing for, you know, years. What if we could learn something from bears. Well, bears don't technically hibernate, if I remember correctly. It's a different.
Well, I think that they are interested in bears. It's something that when they hibernate, they're actually redistributing the calcium back to their bones.
Right.
Or something nuts like that, which they thought, well, if we could just replicate that in humans, that'd be great.
Yeah, because bears are sitting around doing nothing for the period of their winter nap time,
right?
But they're not losing bone in their bone mass density and their muscles. They can still walk at the end of it.
Right.
If a human laid in bed for X number of months, he or she would not necessarily be able to move when they woke up.
And the crux of the problem too is that you might have muscle atrophy, but you can get your muscles back afterward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have some bone loss, but you may not be able to recoup actually all of the bone density that you lost.
Right.
And particularly, the area in your hips. So if you're an astronaut and you reach retirement age, then it's not a great scenario for you, because that's like the number one thing that happens to people in their older years is that they fall and break their hips. So it's actually like a real problem for them.
Yeah, totally. Here are a few other things from the Cyborg paper. They suggested replacing the lung with an inverse fuel cell, altering your intestinal plumbing so that wastewater goes through a filter and right back into your blood, which this is one of those where you can just imagine it coming up in the Mad Men era where it's like, you know, we're wasting a lot of water when we go to the bathroom. I think we can probably pump that through a filter right back into the bloodstream.
Yes. Yes. And to your point too about redistributing the poo, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quote from that paper that says sterilization of the gastrointestinal tract plus intravenous or direct intragastric feeding could reduce fecal elimination to a minimum, and even this might be reutilized. So yes, to your point, they're absolutely thinking about this, eating your own defecation.
Well, that's kind of you're putting the dark spin on it. Light spin on it, minimizing, and hey, you know, I'm a dreamer, one day eliminating pooping. Just completely get rid
altogether.
Of it.
Altogether.
Yeah.
Wow.
What a world we would live in.
Huh. So, that would most assuredly be the death knell for the newspaper industry right there.
Of course, the whole idea of recycling, like urine, of course, we're already doing that, in space.
Right.
We have water filtration systems and of course everybody has the idea of the still suit from the Dune novels, you know, the idea that you could pee in the suit and it would turn back into water. So,
right.
So some of the ideas are like, I would not be opposed to wearing a still suit or if someone said, hey, this water was pee an hour ago, I'd be like, well, you know, a lot of water was pee at some point, so it's no big deal. But the whole idea of like, we're now going to reroute your intestinal system so that the wastewater goes back into your bloodstream. That's a little more extreme.
Right.
But it's an interesting solution. Let's see a few other ones here. Enzyme tinkering to create anaerobic organisms. In other words, astronauts that don't require air or can live in different atmospheres. So that's some extreme makeover right there.
Yeah, and for those types of solutions, I can't help but think, like, how do you recircuit the autonomous part of your body, like your lungs that want to breathe? Like,
mm-hmm.
And I do. I think that all of their solutions are really fascinating, but that to me, those are the sticking points.
Yeah,
like that. Well, the humanness part of our body that wants to do this, how do you shut that off?
To go back to the inner ear thing and getting a little motion sick and weightlessness, they proposed either draining ear fluid or filling them up. So there you go. They said electric / drug cardiovascular control. They recommended drugs to prevent muscle atrophy, which sounds perfectly reasonable.
Right.
Except in their argument, it would probably just happen on its own through something implanted in you, which I guess you would have to get like a refill pack. You'd be kind of like a printer, I'm thinking, on your back where you have like the cyan and the magenta and all this. And
yeah.
You'd get like a little light would show up and it's like, oh, I'm running low on anti-radiation medicine.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there'd be one that would run out the fastest, you know, because it seems like we're always having to replace cyan. I don't know.
It's true. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a weird color. But they also recommended lowering body pressure to facilitate better facilitate spacewalks.
Okay.
Perhaps naked spacewalks. I'm thinking like basically they're saying we would just remove some of the necessary functions of a spacesuit. So that's pretty wild. They also talked about engineering humans to have a light sensitive, chemically regulated system that would change their reflecticity. In other words, you wear a black shirt on a bright day, you end up being hotter. You absorb more of that heat. You wear a white shirt, reflects. So in space, you're going to have situations where you need the heat or don't need the heat because it can make a difference between cooking and freezing.
Is this the protective plastic sponge clothing they were talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which sounded, I don't know. sounded like, I don't know, something in my attic.
Right. Yeah. They also brought up anti-space madness medications.
Yeah.
Anti-psychosis medications, because you're going to be up there for a while in this cramped space. You don't want your fellow astronauts going crazy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, actually, and I noticed that drugs were a huge part of the solution here for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Which makes sense at the time, but I guess not knowing as much about the side effects now.
Well, the thing is, they keep a lot of these type medications on the spaceship.
Yeah.
I have a blog post on this, which I'll also link to when I get around to doing the accompanying blog post for this. But there are a number of different medications that they keep on the shuttle, so it's not just the idea of using them, but having them where they kick in automatically, where it's like you start feeling a little crazy, and then the system that's implanted in your side,
right,
like checks you, you know, so you only feel crazy for a second.
Gosh, I need that now.
Oh, it's interesting. This, if I remember correctly, this, features into Ian M. Banks' culture series where you have the humans have been augmented over time. So everybody has like all these systems that are either subconsciously or consciously control. So they can feel less psychotic or crank up their sort of caffeine level without actually, having something to drink.
It's just actually made me think about this book that I just read, Super Sad True Love Story, I believe is the title.
Oh, yeah.
And they talk about, everybody has something called an apparat, which is they wear around their neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically will tell you every bit of data about yourself, will communicate it to another person. So you could feasibly see what my cholesterol level is.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, whether or not I need to adjust that, or if I even have like little nano robots going through my blood, like cleaning things up, as well as my credit score. It's good stuff, but it just reminded me of that.
They also talked about using pharmaceuticals to kick in some prolonged sleep if you get injured. Like their whole deal is like you're on your return trip from Mars and you stub a toe really badly, or more likely you're injured on a spacewalk, et cetera. You might need to just be able to put that person under for the ride home. It might maybe a condition that can't be or an injury that can't be treated reasonably on the ship.
That was another hallmark, putting people under.
And those are some of the key arguments that they made. From there, they went on to do a number of other cyborg studies where each one dealt with another level. Like Cyborg 2 dealt with the manipulation of human emotions through mental exercises. And this one involved like a lot of hypnosis, like the idea of using hypnosis and I could see like meditation being a big thing too.
Yeah, they mentioned yoga too in the paper.
Yoga in space. Can you do, have done more yoga than me. Could you do yoga without gravity?
Yeah, I assume you could do some of the poses, right? Never having done it.
Yeah.
In a gravity-free environment, I'm not quite sure, but yeah.
I don't know. It seems like the different balancing poses would be kind of pointless, and like down dog, I don't know.
Does
down dog even count if there's no gravity?
No, it doesn't. You're right. I mean, I think you'd have to have your compression suit on. And perhaps you'd have to do like partner yoga with one person holding you down.
This would be interesting if anybody out there has any thoughts on what a microgravity yoga technique would consist of.
Right.
I'll have to ask my yoga teacher. that level. I will do it.
Okay.
All right. So then Cyborg 3 was genetic alterations to enhance the human emotional range. Cyborg 4, deeper genetic changes. And then Cyborg 5, ultimately, they were talking about the separation of mind from body, it's the idea is like perhaps instead of sending humans to this hostile environment, you fall back on the human creation that is best suited for space travel, the machine.
Right.
If we could just simply put our consciousness in it or somehow experience what the machine is experiencing, you know, remotely.
We could have some sort of implant that tied into the robots or...
Yeah, like it, more or less an extension of what we're already doing.
We just more data.
Yeah, we talked a big game, you know, about sending humans to Mars, but ultimately we can send robots there, and we can, you know, move our hands on a keyboard and move things on Mars. We can look through a screen and see what's happening on Mars. And as that technology improves, it's basically like we're there. And without having to worry about how you're going to feed this person, how are you going to keep them alive, how are you going to, you know, tackle the huge obstacles of engineering a person that can survive this environment.
That makes sense to me. I mean, to do the sort of surveillance that you need, right, to have nanorobots or just robots go out and accumulate all that data. The thing that I think about is what's missing there is like the overview effect, right? The reporting back of the human part of it.
Yeah.
So yes, the we've talked about this before in a podcast about the overview effect, that sense of euphoria you get and this deeper, better understanding of the planet that you live in.
Yeah, like the Grand Canyon example is great. Like, I've never been to the Grand Canyon, but I've only seen photos of it. It looks really cool in the photos, but everyone will tell you that's been there that the photos just don't cut it, that you don't really, like, understand the Grand Canyon until you see it.
Right.
Which I totally buy, because, I mean, that's how seeing anything, you know, amazing works. It's like the photo, the video, it can really capture a moment or a string of moments, but it's not the same as being there.
Yeah. But then, you know, I don't know. I think about that. Yes, robots makes so much more sense, but, you know, seems like I've been bringing this up a lot, but like the exoskeletons we talked about, the military is using, you know, is there a way to combine that technology as well as the carbon nanotube muscles that they're trying to create to glom that onto the human to again make them more of this this cyborg in reality, as opposed to the future that we keep pointing to.
Yeah. So one of the big questions that comes to mind when we talk about all these different variations on the cyborg is that if we change humans to live in space or live in another world, at what point are they no longer human? You know, like what, you know, you get to where you're adding a lot of hardware, you're genetically altering somebody, and then you're sending them out. And is that a human being anymore? Is it something else? Is it a subspecies?
I don't know. Paul Davies of SETI has actually said that biological intelligence is only a transitory phenomenon, a fleeting phase in the evolution of the universe. Mm-hmm. And so his feeling is that this applies to humans, and if there are indeed extraterrestrial life out there, that it's got to be some sort of machine hybrid. So, and this is an idea that's come up before, is aliens is these more evolved replications or iterations of ourselves that are the sort of machine cyborg being.
Yeah. And it falls back in line with what we were talking about earlier. Like, it comes to, like Cyborg 5 was talking about, like, basically machines with human intellects, you know? It's, it becomes more of a, I mean, just look at what we've sent out. We've sent machines. Machines have been the first to land on Mars, on the moon. The first, gonna be the first to leave the solar system.
So is the definition then, if the brain is intact, then we're still human?
But, well, I think we would kind of like that to be the case, but again, we're not just our brains. It's like we're a much more complicated system than that.
That's right. To bring up the gut.
Yeah. So anyway, it's an interesting question. At what point would we not be human anymore? At what point are we already not human? There's a 1997 stat that, and this is 97, which argued that, that 10% of the human population was already a cyborg, just counting like everything from, you know, pacemakers, to prosthetics, to dentures, that there was just a huge, huge segment of the population that was already not fully human.
Right.
And certainly, I mean, if you start counting clothing, like none of us are, except for those few nudists out there, they're keeping it real for the original humans.
We salute you.
Yeah. So there you have it. But we're not quite done with the brain and the gut yet, because we have a little listener mail.
Speaking of how important it is that our gut tell us what to do and not what to do?
This is from reader Ryan, who writes in about our recent episode about the gut and the mind. And they said, quote, your episode on the stomach's influence on the mind struck my interest in regard to eating disorders also. As a late teen, I had a peculiar and sudden onset of a few life-altering issues like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, manic depression, more manic than depressive, frankly, which can be very destructive, he adds. And eventually a very long bout with anorexia, which initiated as a coping mechanism with the IBS. The IBS almost completely subsided by my early 20s, but the anorexia persisted, and it really felt like I didn't have control over my own body. I often compare it to how a heavy substance addiction must feel. I dedicate a lot of insight into eating disorders because they are so misunderstood as being fueled by vanity, which just isn't the case, not always anyway. With these new insights on how much the stomach affects the mind, I'm excited to see what this will mean for the underlying and treatment of eating disorders on the whole. I mean, I'm sorry, for the understanding and treatment. And again, that was from our reader, Ryan.
Which I think is really interesting because that is what neurogastroenterologists are pointing to. They are saying, like, is the gut the problem here? Is the gut the one that is mentally unstable and sending all these signals up to the brain and confusing matters?
Right.
So you gotta look out for that one. It's going to be big news here.
And on a lighter note, in response to the same episode, Kevin writes in and says, just reassuring your podcast by saying that I probably listen to my gut more than I listen to my brain, because every time I listen to my brain, it leads me in the wrong direction. But when I listen to my stomach, I generally have a better time.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
You know, what I think is interesting is we started out this podcast talking about flatus.
Yeah.
We've just closed the circle with the gut.
There's no avoiding it. As much as we would like to, we haven't reached that point where we have engineered the humans that no longer emit flatus or poop. So
that's right. No scatological free humans.
Yeah. So hey, if you have anything to add to that, and certainly if you're that one or very few one of the very few individuals out there who is flatus free, do let us know. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Where we are Blow the Mind on both of those.
We won't shun you, we promise.
No, we won't shun you.
You can also send us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.